This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Welcome back, folks. We are joined by Guy Williams, President, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. He joins us every Monday in the 12 o'clock hour to discuss the national, state, local economy and so many other issues. Guy, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you very much. Good to be with you.
So, Guy, the Congressional Budget Office is reporting out the amount of the deficit that for the fiscal year that just ended September 30th, and they report $1.8 trillion worth of red ink, which is the highest budget deficit in U.S. history other than the period of time during COVID-19. What does this mean?
Well, it's unfortunate because we're in a strong economy and the deficit was higher than it was in 2023, higher than it was in 2022. So we're seeing spending exceed revenue year after year, and we're on a path that, you know, we hear this phrase unsustainable. It truly is unsustainable. We can't keep doing it forever. Unfortunately, we're also in the political season. And this is the Oprah Winfrey moment where you get a car, you get a car, you get a car, and both teams are proposing different giveaways to taxpayers in the final 2 weeks of the election. So we're not hearing any discussion of fiscal restraint from Team D or Team R. So it makes it tough for forecasters to expect that the deficit will come down, and that's going to be a problem. We really do have to address it. I hope we'll start talking about it sensibly as soon as the election is over. But right now, I think everybody's in denial.
And, you know, we're talking about some really substantial increases. They report out as well that the education budget went from $135 billion in 2019, the year before COVID, to right now it's at this last year was at $305 billion, and I think that number is going to go up even more. So it's like we've not really come off of the COVID mentality yet, and it's going to be curious to see how long it's going to take to do so.
Well, we also have some other problems. If you look globally, this is probably one of the scariest times in terms of geopolitical risk. And we're actually spending less on defense adjusted for inflation than we did last year. So areas that we really need to focus on, unfortunately, look, nobody wants to spend a ton of money on defense, but we don't have an option. That's a challenge. Interest has gone up tremendously. It was $832 billion this year versus $650 last year. And that's going to keep increasing because you have to pay interest on all the accumulated deficit, and it keeps getting bigger month by month.
If you would, for the benefit of the listening audience, I think a lot of folks don't realize that we're actually paying interest on this debt.
Oh, yeah. I mean, when the federal government spends money that it doesn't have, it has to borrow the difference, and that's U.S. Treasury bills. And when that happens, the government has to, every month, every quarter, make interest payments. So when you add more borrowing, you add more interest, and that's just a real challenge. It also is the reason why, when you look at what's called the yield curve, how much does it cost to borrow money for 6 months, for a year, for 10 years, the rate on the 10-year Treasury is higher today than it was in January. The rate on the 30 is higher than it was in January. And we always hear the Fed's cutting rates. The Fed can cut short-term rates because they control the Fed funds rate. The long-term rate is controlled by the market. And the market is saying we need more interest to cover the risk of holding debt long term. And unfortunately, that's likely to keep going up until we get some sort of handle on the deficit.
So when we think about this particular happenstance, the last time I think we actually balanced the budget was during the Clinton years, if my memory serves me correct, right?
You're exactly right.
What would it take for us to be able to accomplish same? I mean, I know the overall general statement is we just got to cut spending. Nobody likes to do that. It's politically unpopular because somebody's pocket is being picked, so to speak, in order to get there. But when we think about the magnitude of what we're dealing with today, what would it look like?
Well, it can be done a number of ways. One is to not make the hole any deeper and to say, okay, we're going to stop whatever amount we're spending right now. That's the amount we're going to spend next year, and not let the spending go up. Don't make an inflation adjustment. And yeah, that would be slightly painful, but it would take about 5 to 6 years, and spending and expense would go up to get spending and income would match. So that's one way to do it. It would require some discipline. We'd have to tell people, look, there aren't going to be inflation adjustments for a while. It's hard to do it with taxes, and we've talked about this before, but even during World War II, we never collected more than 20% of GDP in taxes. Right now, we're collecting, you know, a little above 19. So the idea that you can raise taxes and balance the budget, people tend to adjust their patterns of income. So we're spending about 26% of GDP and collecting about 19. So that leaves a big gap, which is going to have to be met one way or another. But it's either going to have to be restraining spending. It's unlikely to be raising taxes because it's hard to collect much more income unless you do a sales tax. And that's been very, very unpopular because it hits the poorest the hardest.
So one of the things that this most recent report also revealed is that there was a surge in tax revenue of roughly $480 billion, which was an 11% increase over the previous year. But of that, Social Security payments increased by $107 billion. So that's the government paying folks, and that's what's creating this tax increase. How does that impact this overall picture when you have things like that? And then the other category that they talked about is that Medicare payments grew by $78 billion or 9% because of new enrollees and higher rates paid to service providers. So that's on the other side of the ledger. But these two things eat up a lot of what we're actually talking about when we talk about an increase in tax revenue, but it's actually government dollars going out and I guess dollars coming back to the government is kind of the way I'm viewing it. Is that wrong? Or
yeah, I've always thought when we advertise things like the lottery and we say you won $1 million and then the government takes back $300,000 in taxes, it's like, wait a minute, I really only won $700,000. So when government money goes out that's taxable, it comes back in as tax revenue. And some Social Security benefits are taxable, and there's been talk about making those tax-free. So those changes, those things do sort of come back. But the thing that is really pushing the revenue is the economy is still pretty strong. So we've had increase in jobs. We've had increase in Social Security payments because more people are working. And the challenge is we just keep spending even more. So even as revenue goes up, spending is going up faster, and that's what creates the hole, and that's why it's worse this year than it was last year.
So when we look at what we're hearing, and I just was telling the audience that we're going to talk about a number of policy issues between now and the election. One of the issues, obviously, is the economic impact. You mentioned it earlier, and we have some that are saying we're going to tax the wealthy. They got to pay more of their fair share. But when you get to doing the back of the envelope calculation on all of this, none of it ever raises enough money to really cover what they're promising, right? Is that what you're seeing at the present time?
Yeah, I mean, it's very popular, and we know this in Louisiana. Back in the early long days, is, you know, he had a saying, don't tax you, don't tax me, tax the man behind the tree. It's always good politically to say tax somebody else. And one of the things we hear about is taxing billionaires, which is a little bit of political jujitsu, because now we're not taxing income, we're taxing wealth, which we've never done historically except for property taxes. But let's imagine we tax billionaires. All the billionaires in America have a net worth of about $2 trillion. So when you tax, if you took all the money away, it would basically cover the deficit for a year. And then what do you do next year? And what have you done to the economy? So the idea that we can just make the billionaires pay and nothing will change is just mathematically flawed. It can't work.
Yeah. And I guess I'm having difficulty where people are thinking, oh, this is great on the front end, right? It sounds all wonderful. But at some point, it will come home to roost. And we have folks saying that that's not necessarily true. Your thoughts?
Oh, no. The deficit problem will come home to roost. We'll have a day of accounting and reckoning, and it will either result in a dramatic cut in spending, perhaps a very deep recession, or incredible inflation, which is very, very painful and is another challenge for the government. But when you do something that can't last, it truly can't last. It's just, how does it end? And it's intriguing. If you look at Germany, it's the one country where, despite their challenges with a slowing economy, their debt as a percent of GDP is declining. And the reason is Germany experienced hyperinflation between the wars, and they saw how it devastated the country. But they also saw that the hyperinflation made the people so mad that they voted in that lunatic Adolf Hitler. And so economists, when you get them in a quiet room, will say, you really never want to go to hyperinflation because it pushes voters beyond reason, and they could elect somebody that would be absolutely intolerable. And as I say, that's the one reason Germany always controls their spending, is they've seen firsthand how awful it can be when you get into hyperinflation. And that's one of the ways that having no control of your deficit could end. And I don't think we're going to get there, but it's certainly something we want to be careful about.
We get a lot of questions here because both sides or both candidates are talking a lot about tariffs. There's a lot of talk by Trump relative to like super tariffs, enhanced tariffs. There's been talk by President Joe Biden and now Vice President Kamala Harris. And I was reading an article the other day that said that President Biden actually had more tariffs on the books than Trump did during his 4 years of his administration. If you would briefly explain for the benefit of the listening audience tariffs and how they work.
Yeah. You know, way back in the day when the country was founded, most of our tax revenue came from tariffs. We taxed goods coming in. But what we discovered as America grew is that for a growing economy, it's actually better to have low, very predictable tariffs, because each country has skills that other countries lack. So it's better to import things from somebody that does it very efficiently, and then you do what you're better at. And so the conventional wisdom, and it really is true, is it's better to have not excessively high tariffs. Use them occasionally if your trade partners are doing something dishonest or illegal in their trading practices. But if, For example, China wants to send us solar panels at a deep discount, which they do. President Biden and Vice President Harris have said we're going to have big tariffs on Chinese solar panels. Well, that actually doesn't make sense. I mean, if we're trying to do a green environment and China wants to send us discounted solar panels, you know, God bless them. Let them do it, and then we'll do things that are better for us. So you have both sides talking about tariffs. You know, one group wants to have tariffs on electric vehicles made overseas to protect American manufacturers. One of the big dangers is sometimes you'll have politicians trying to protect their industry with a tariff, and you end up making your industry uncompetitive. It's the same thing as if you're trying to protect your children from competition in sports and you don't let them play good teams. Well, eventually they will have to face somebody that's actually good at the sport, and they'll be embarrassingly bad. And probably one of the best examples of this is England was trying to protect BSA motorcycles, and they didn't want them to compete with the Japanese because they had the Honda motorcycles and Yamaha and Suzuki. So they kept subsidizing their BSA motorcycles. And when Margaret Thatcher came in, she realized they were subsidizing the company so much that they were literally doing a greater subsidy per motorcycle than they were paying in wages. Would have been better just to write checks to the employees, because BSA got progressively less competitive. My fear is if we try and protect American EV manufacturers, the same thing will happen. They'll become less competitive globally, and eventually they'll be in a terrible situation compared to the rest of the world. And that's one of the things that we're proposing tariffs on are foreign EVs, or electrical vehicles.
And interestingly, there's criticism going back and forth, but the reality is that both sides of the aisles are very proactive in the tariff landscape.
Oh, absolutely. President Trump put in a lot of tariffs during his 4 years in office. President Biden did not reverse the Trump tariffs. He essentially left those in place, notwithstanding that he'd campaigned against them, and imposed a few more. So it is politically expedient to talk about tariffs because it seems like you're picking on the bad foreigners, and people don't see the loss for the American economy. And it would be better, once again, to have low, predictable tariffs, have our foreign competitors compete on a level playing field with us. But, you know, that's not something that works well in a soundbite. It's hard to explain competitive advantage and the reason that it's better for us to do what we're best at and let other countries do what they're best at.
So when you hear someone, and I've heard President Trump say this and President Biden as well, talk about taking a defensive posture because, let's just use China as an example, they have huge tariffs on American imports in China that we need to respond or retaliate in kind. Your thoughts?
Well, we made a mistake with China, and the mistake was we thought that when China became capitalist that they would also become democratic. What China did is their managers said the most efficient economic system in the world is capitalism, so we're going to adopt that, but we're going to remain an absolute brutal dictatorship, and the Communist Party is going to have absolute power. And so they made that decision, and we let them join the World Trade Organization, which is a rules-based trade group, and then they proceeded to break all the rules. But our challenge is that we and the Europeans did not immediately say, no, guys, you know, these are the rules. You cannot break them. You're going to be booted out of the World Trade Organization if you don't stop. And the whole history of Chinese diplomacy is they will push up until somebody says no. And it's just their philosophy of government. Let's take as much as we can. And when people finally say no, okay, then we'll stop. But we didn't say no. The Europeans didn't say no. And they violated the free trade rules that they agreed to. So That's our problem, and we really need to go back and say, look, guys, you signed this agreement. No one made you do it. You have to live up to these agreements. If you don't, then we will have punitive tariffs because that's the consequence under the World Trade Organization. But we, neither side has wanted to draw that line, and I think regardless of who wins, they probably should look at that and say, look, China, you have to live up to the agreements that you signed. When you sign a global agreement, you have to live to the terms.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting because there's so much political messaging around this that seems to be a little bit misleading, deflecting and evading when questions are asked about it. And that's why I asked you to explain how this works to the listening audience, because even those that read a lot about this find it really, really confusing. And still to this day, I find it all very confusing as trying to figure out who's doing what to who, right? and why in so many respects. All right, we got to get to a break. We're visiting with Guy Williams, president, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust, 504-260-1870. We'll be right back after the break.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. We're visiting with Guy Williams, president, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. Been talking a lot about the national economy. Guy, recently the green folks are fighting against wind power?
Yeah, this is one of the unfortunate realities of trying to do anything right now in the United States. The chairman of Vestas, one of the big European energy wind power companies, said that America is the most painful part of our global portfolio.
Wow.
And, yeah, not where you want to be. So here's what's happening. If you imagine a map of the United States, if you look at the New England coast and the western coast, California, Oregon, Washington, those are the best areas for wind power. We wish it was the Gulf of Mexico. It's not, because the wind doesn't blow as much as it does there. But northeast, northwest are perfect for wind power. Southwest, that middle area, California, Nevada, Arizona, Texas, perfect for solar power. And if an engineer were designing the green transition, they would put all the wind power in the northeast and the northwest, all the solar in the that southwest corner and South Florida, and then an interconnected grid. The problem is we have environmentalists that are suing green power companies to stop green energy. And Oregon is probably the picture and the worst picture of this. There was supposed to be an auction of offshore sites in Oregon. It was canceled. Canceled at the government's request because the bidders withdrew. There were so many objections, and so many groups had threatened to sue. Literally, they said, we're going to paper you with lawsuits, that they just threw in the towel and said, okay, we're just not going to do it. We're going to defer the auction. We'll gather more info and come back to it at a later date.
So obviously, federal government subsidizing a lot of this stuff. We've heard about these leases both on the East Coast as well. Recently, I've heard that they've run into issues, cost overruns, a lot of that by supply chain costs as well as our inflation rate here driving the cost of goods up. And what they thought they could develop these wind fields for is X plus. So where does this leave the industry now here in this country?
Well, there are a number of challenges, and I think one of them is, in the initial blush of enthusiasm, some energy companies made fixed-price bids and said, okay, we'll sell power at this price. Now, they were looking at the European wind farms and thinking that they could develop them as quickly as the Europeans did. They didn't realize that it is very hard to build anything in the U.S. right now. We just create a lot of delays. And so time went on. COVID occurred. Supplies went up. Supply chains broke down for a while. When the supply chains reopened, the prices were higher for everything. So all of the turbine blades, all the equipment, all the installation was higher. And you had a number of companies walk away from their deals in New England, including writing off $3 to $4 billion of investment, saying, we just don't want to do it right now. It doesn't make sense. The challenge for the U.S. is in New England, where we have a couple of wind farms that are up and running, you had a problem with a turbine blade falling off. So that caused a halt in production from that field until they could investigate it. And in the meantime, you had a plethora of groups rise up to protest wind farms. You have ACK for Wales, Stop the High-Risk Power Cable, Green Ocean, Defend Brighton Beach, and Save Long Beach. All of these groups have filed suits. All of them are fighting wind power on different environmental issues, some about whales, some about scallops, some about power lines. The challenge, and Newell, you can imagine if you're a developer, you don't know how long a lawsuit will last. Once you get involved in that, it could take years. And so you can't make an economic projection of, okay, if I start investing, if I do the design and installation, I'll be able to open in a year, 18 months, because the lawsuits throw uncertainty into the mix. And that's really put a stop on a lot of the momentum that we had in wind power. And, you know, wind power can make sense, but it doesn't make sense with the lawsuits. It doesn't make sense without an interconnected grid. And it certainly doesn't make sense without certainty of permitting, that you can get your permits and get it built in a reasonable period of time. And so the federal government had attempted to subsidize some of these, but there's not enough money to throw at the projects to deal with the uncertainty. And so we're in a real tough situation where the government wants to do something, but it's not taking the steps that are necessary to make it happen.
So in the end, what these European companies are saying, that the difficulty of the regulatory side of this is really causing them significant concern. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. And they're saying, look, we've been doing wind power for 30 years. We know how to do it. We can make it work. But you have to give a certainty. And people forget Joe Manchin, who's retiring now from the U.S. Senate, was a Democratic senator. He said, we've got to reform permitting in the United States. We have to have a short window to file lawsuits. We have to have a short window to have decision making so that people can know if you propose a project, it will get built. And unfortunately, what we're doing is, because we're concerned about the environment, we're preventing things that would cause environmental improvement from occurring, and we're making them much more expensive. So it's a real unfortunate situation. We call it the green versus green, the green nihilist fighting the green rationalist, and the government has not stepped up with a permitting reform bill. And that was something, once again, Joe Manchin really wanted and didn't get done. But it's something Congress is going to have to do if they want to expand wind power. They're going to have a streamlined permitting, short review period. I mean, after all, the Europeans have been doing wind energy for 30 years. We know what the environmental consequences are. We don't need to do another decade of studies. If this is something we want to build, you have to let people build them. If it's something we don't want to build, let's quit pretending and move on to other things.
So we obviously have these warring or rival political factions then, and even an administration like the Biden-Harris administration, who allegedly these factions are on their side, have not been able to pull them together to overcome these regulatory hurdles that we've put in place through multiple administrations, right?
Yeah, and it's one reason the Journal of Science studied all of the environmental programs around the world, 1,500 different programs, and found that only 32 of them actually reduced emissions. It's like, we ought to, as a country, step back and say, if this is our objective, let's do the things that work. Let's quit doing the things that don't work. Let's not subsidize things. When President Obama was in office, they did a big study, had a future Nobel Prize winner lead it to see how effective subsidies were in moving the needle on green energy. And the result was not very. And so when they saw that, they buried the report and just ignored it. And we came up with more subsidies, which are really not the effective way to solve this problem. If you want to solve the problem, subsidizing, you know, certain industries and certain groups is not the way to go about it. And, you know, the scientific studies have confirmed it. The administration's own study confirmed it. But it's hard not to do it because you have an awful lot of political supporters and donors that are very fond of being subsidized.
Yeah, it's just, you find it odd that with all of that, as you point out, the subsidies that are given and everything else, that it gets them to a point, but they really still can't get to the finish line. And that's what they're complaining about. And, time kills all deals, right?
Oh, it absolutely does. My friend Don Randon gave me a clock with no hands on it, and the slogan is time kills deals. And yeah. The environmental groups know that. They even said in one of their press releases, we're going to pepper them with lawsuits and kill the projects with delay. So until you deal with that, you're not going to solve the problem. And, you know, I hate to see the U.S. identifying a problem and then not effectively moving to solve it.
Yeah, frustrating at best. All right, we're visiting with Guy Williams, president of Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. We've got to get to a break. We will be right back, folks. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. We're visiting with Guy Williams, president of Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. Been talking about a number of issues. This one is one that's current and been very important. Guy, you say that there's whiplash at the Federal Reserve as rate cuts may be later and possibly smaller. Tell us about it.
The Federal Reserve is really dealing with a challenge right now. They've said that they're going to be data dependent, and the data is coming in a number of different ways. So the U.S. Retail Trade Group say that they expect a slow Christmas. Walgreens is closing 1,000 stores. Nestle's is cutting its forecast for growth as shoppers are retreating. We have a decline in luxury sales. Even the Louis Vuitton is seeing sales go down. And so you hear all those things and you think, all right, that the economy is slowing and obviously the Fed needs to cut rates, except sales for retailers on everything else are up 0.4 in September compared to 0.1 growth in August. So retail sales are showing broad-based strength. Employment is going up. You know, we had layoffs and we had a challenge of rising unemployment, but the last ADP payroll report showed strong growth in employment. Wages are going up faster than inflation, and the GDP is going up at 3.4%. So the Federal Reserve is looking at both sides of this. Is the economy slowing or is it accelerating? Is inflation increasing or declining? Core inflation actually bounced up to 3.3%. So the Fed is now saying, you know, we're just not sure what's happening. Probably just do 25 basis points in November, maybe nothing. And some of the Fed governors are saying, you know, it could be possible that we have to really slow down. Governor Waller, Governor Logan, and even Chairman Powell said, this is just going to have to be a gradual adjustment based upon data.
Which runs contrary to everyone's expectations, right? I mean, I think everyone got caught up in the hoopla with the 50 basis point cut, roughly a month ago. And I got to imagine this messaging is having a chilling effect.
Oh, it really is. And the other thing is, people hear rates are going down and they think that means that my mortgage rate is going to go down. So someone buying a house will get a lower rate. Mortgage rates have gone up. And we talked about that earlier, but 10-year rates and out are not susceptible to the Fed. That's the market does that. And the market is saying, you know, we think maybe in the long run there might be higher inflation. And so that's really having a as you say, a chilling effect on the home sales. And it's combined with the increase in home cost, which has not slowed down, as well as the increase in insurance. And then the corresponding other thing, consumer confidence is actually declining right now. So the Fed's looking at, well, wait, a bunch of indicators are going up, sales are going down, confidence is going down. You know, what's really happening here? And it is hard to tell, but it looks like inflation is more persistent than they expected. And certainly the economy is stronger than they expected.
But not broad-based, right? I mean, it's kind of very, it's more in some areas than in others. I'm trying to find the right term.
You're exactly right. The payroll people will tell you that. Said we're seeing the most bifurcated labor market we've ever seen. It used to be that in the U.S. people would easily move for a new job, and now people are stuck because they might have a very low-rate mortgage, so they're not willing to move to a city, you know, hundreds of miles away because of a job. So mobility is down. There's a shift in jobs. There's some jobs that are just, you know, declining rapidly, and if you think about it, it makes sense. Data entry, keyboard operators, telephone operators, marketing, oddly enough, very low demand for marketers right now, software development, journalism majors. I have a friend that's in journalism, and she said, you know, the journalism school should be arrested. They produce enough graduates every year to fill all of the jobs in journalism. So,
wow.
Way oversupplied. On the flip side, physicians, medical assistants, physical therapists, truck drivers, engineers, and any of the skilled trades, very short supply. So you've got a totally bifurcated market. And you could imagine if you lost your job as a telephone operator, you can't become an HVAC technician overnight. That's not really a transferable skill. So there's a mismatch between job openings and job skills that makes it hard to forecast the labor market. But nonetheless, there was more hiring last month than the prior month.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what the Fed does and how they react to this. Obviously, the markets are always reacting in advance, and we'll check in with that maybe with you next week. We've been visiting with Guy Williams, President, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. Guy, thank you so much for joining us. We always appreciate your time and your insight. Have a great week.
Oh, you're very welcome. Good to be with you.
We will be right back and check in with Scoot when we return. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and text line. Stay with us, folks. Scoot joins us. What do we have coming up, Scoot?
Well, Olivia Dunn, the gymnast for LSU, has shared some bikini pictures with us from her vacation in Florida with her boyfriend, Paul Skeens. So we'll talk a little bit about that. We've got to get into politics. We'll talk about Trump's favorite farm animal, Trump at McDonald's, and some of the early voting and how it's going. And we will definitely talk about LSU and Tulane's victory.
Scoot's up next, folks. Stay tuned. He's got a great lineup coming your way. Hope you enjoyed today's show. Have a great Monday evening, and we'll see you guys again in the morning.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance, too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.